This is the current federal tax developments for the week of March the 7th, 2016. Current federal tax developments are brought to you by Nichols Patrick CP Incorporated and your state society of CPAs. And this week we're seeing a few extra states that are coming along with us. We've got a few issues here. In fact, we're now opening up so that everybody hopefully has access here. And for those who don't know about it, we also are pushing now that we have a video feed of this on the current federal tax development site that those of you with the webcast can now pick up. So those of you here. And this is, as I mentioned, brought to you by all of the state societies of CPAs. It is actually our work for them that enables us to be able to do this for you. So I want to make sure that you pay attention to what's going on over there, pay attention to the courses they're offering. And yes, even this time of year, generally for non-tax purposes, they're offering courses. But we can go ahead and find all kinds of neat things there at your state society of CPAs for signing up for education. But even though it's tax season, and even though we like for all the developments to stop during tax season so we can actually end up doing the tax work, reality is things keep happening, and that's why we have this week to discuss with you a number of developments that have occurred in the current week. So we'll get ourselves started now, and we'll get ourselves back into the mix. So moving forward, what we have today is we've started with a number of developments that we have here in today's tax, and the first one is unfortunately a continuation of a problem we're seeing consistently. In fact, the first couple are going to be continuations of these same problems. This one deals with the fact that the IRS is alerting payroll and human resource professionals, and I should add controllers, to a phishing scheme that involves W-2s. What they're trying to do is get information related to payroll from companies. In this particular case, the online scam works like this. The taxpayer in this question, the controller or the HR person, will receive an email. That email will purport to come from a president, CEO, some high-ranking person in the organization. That will claim that, hey, you know what? We need information related to the payroll. Can you please send to me information related to, you know, the employees and the actual things being asked for? Some of the data that we've seen in the actual emails the IRS gave us was statements like, kindly send me the individual 2015 W-2 parenthesis PDF, close parenthesis, and earning summaries of all W-2 of our company's staff for a quick review. Can you send me the updated list of employees with full details, name, social security number, date of birth, home address, and salary? Or I want you to send me the list of the W-2 copy, the employee's wage and tax statements for 2015. I need them in the PDF file type. You can send it as an attachment. Kindly prepare the list and email them to me as soon as possible. The concept being that the person gets an email. It appears to be coming from their boss, that is somebody who can decide that they no longer work for the company, and they get them to send the information quickly. The problem, of course, is this email is not coming from the boss. Rather, this email is coming from someone most likely outside the country, because it's a lot easier if you're going to pull a scam like this to not be in the same country, since that makes it a little bit easier to be prosecuted. And they're going to send this information off. This information then will be used for ID theft or other nefarious purposes against the employees of the company. And oh, by the way, that probably is going to include the president of the company or the owner. Now, you may ask how this is pulled off. The problem these days is we put a lot of information out on the web. Most companies these days have websites that give details about information like who is the president, who's the CEO, who's the owner. It may give us information about who the controller is or who the HR people are. It, in essence, gives a nefarious party all the information they need to be able to craft an email. And please, everybody in the organization needs to understand it is trivial to fake the from address in an email. It is definitely something that's fairly simple to do. And they craft these things, and there actually are sites where you can run tests. There actually are sites, it's kind of interesting, that will actually try to make sure that your malware is tested against all the normal and, you know, all the commercial systems out there to stop your malware from getting into the network. And so they'll clear it. They'll obfuscate it in the perfect ways to get it through. It's kind of nice to know that they're apparently where a market arises, somebody decides to sell to that market, maybe unfortunately in this case. And so that appears to be information coming there. And people who don't understand this is very possible that an email did not come from the president, of course, succumb to this immediately. We need to be very careful. First thing is we need to notify any organization about the fact that they should never, never, never trust the email. You know, you've got to go back and cross-verify. I don't care. You should tell the CEOs, presidents, et cetera, about these scams, because if they are used to making, you know, last-minute demands loudly to send attachments via email, please point out how things like this can happen. By the way, the other side of this, very closely related, that some people may have been aware of, not really tax-related, but there's a similar scam that comes up that rather than getting the W-2s, has somebody, the CEO, demand that the controller make a large wire transfer to another party. Again, presidents and CEOs need to understand that do not communicate those sorts of things via email, and definitely tell your staff that they are not to take any action on email like that. Unfortunately, too many people, including CEOs, presidents, and owners, have gotten too used to just using email, and they don't care about what it works. They just want things done. And that sets up these scams. Well, continuing down the scam route, we got another scam problem again. Well, this is a continuation of an old one. The IRS now has increased the number of people whose transcripts were accessed in an unauthorized manner last year, up to now 720,000 taxpayers. Again, this was the scam where the third parties went in, went to the Get a Transcript site, provided information about Social Security numbers, AGI, and then answered these out-of-wallet questions. These are things that only third parties are, that only the taxpayer is supposed to know. Theory being, well, that's perfect. Unfortunately, databases are being built where individuals, where we can now find on the basis of an individual where nefarious parties can get that information about the individual essentially by simple lookup. This is a problem not just for the IRS, but a lot of other places use these, oh, there's no problem, we're just have these questions, and nobody but the taxpayer or substitute my client will know this information. Unfortunately, these days, with the databases these guys are putting together, it's very simple to get that information, give it back, and get whatever it is that we thought we were only giving to the party that was supposed to get it. Be very, very careful. And just to make things even better, later in the week, we had reports that on Krebs on Security wrote up a story about a CPA who had been issued an IP PIN and then discovered that this year her IP PIN had been hijacked. Remember, the IRS allows you to go online and get your IP PIN. If you forgot it, a client lost their IP PIN, they can go online, and if they answer some questions, they'll get a new one issued. If that sounds suspiciously like the way transcripts works, it is. And the problem, of course, is that what parties are doing now is when a reject comes back and says, oh, the return's rejected, there must be an IP PIN. These are those filing fraudulent returns. Well, they just go and then get the IP PIN, get that changed, and then go ahead and file the fraudulent return. And now they're even better off because it turns out, of course, that IP PIN was supposed to guarantee that was the right return. So now your client's in even more trouble. How did that one work? Problem simple. Before they had this system, if a client lost their IP PIN, they were just totally out of luck. They were going to be filing paper and stuck back forever, or have to get back on the phone with the IRS, produce a lot of documentation, get a new IP PIN sent by mail. Again, this would take weeks. They might have to go on extension. That was inconvenient. They whined that they were already a victim. Why were they making this so difficult? So the IRS decided not to make it difficult. Fundamental rule of security. Difficult things that are easy and user-friendly quite often are insecure. And things that are secure are quite often a pain to work with. And we've got to decide our choices here. Do we want the security or do we want the ease of use? Because currently the problem is our attempts to thread the middle of that are coming under attack because the people who want to get that information just simply figure out how to exploit whatever system we're using to make it easy. So be careful there. And also, don't be surprised, apparently, the CPA reported to Brian Krebs that she was told on the phone. Of course, we often get told stuff like this by IRS employees, so you got to kind of always take this with a grain of salt, but that there had been a number of such things already this year. There's a whole bunch of problems that they've already noticed. Nothing's been published aside from that, though we've now seen with Brian's article, some other sites and some accounting sites have now picked this up. But be aware of the problem. Next up, we can actually get to some tax stuff. This is the case of Guidant LLC versus Commissioner, 146 TC number 5, issued on February 29th of 2016, a leap day case. So, hey, you know, once every 4 years we get leap day cases. Guidant is a leap day case and a published tax court case. So, hey, we've got both issues there. In this case, we have a taxpayer, Guidant LLC. The IRS under section 44, should say 82 of the code, the IRS is allowed if there are transactions between parties that have relationships, direct or indirect, and it appears to the IRS that they are using these to misstate income, the IRS has the ability to basically restructure the transactions. That's 482 very broadly. So what they want to do is adjust income transferred between related entities. This was between a Guidant LLC is filing as a consolidated corporation. It's got a lot of subsidiaries. Some of those subsidiaries entered into transactions with foreign entities that are related to Guidant but are not obviously part of the consolidated return. The IRS said, wait a minute, we think what you're doing is you're charging the wrong amounts for these transactions, in essence having the foreign company pay more than it should. So what we want to do is come back and pull some of that back in by, you know, basically having the foreign company, I should say, charge more than they should, or pay less than they should, whichever way you want to do that for your transactions. So the IRS said, we want to make these 42 adjustments on all these transactions with your subsidiary. However, rather than going on a subsidiary by subsidiary level and making adjustments to each sub to come up with the subsidiary's taxable income and then come up to consolidated taxable income, the IRS instead made all the adjustments at the parent level. The parent company had not engaged in any of these transactions. So the question became, in essence, as a matter of law, and it's important to understand this is it was a motion for summary judgment. This is not a statement that, in fact, the IRS is going to win on this issue or that they might not have been better for them to do it the other way when we get to the actual question at trial of showing the facts. But Guidant argued as a matter of law, they adjusted the parent. The parent had no transactions that were subject to the 482 adjustments. Therefore, the IRS's case should be thrown out at this level. The tax court did not agree. The tax court said, as a matter of law, the IRS is not required to make adjustments down to the subsidiary level or even to break down the details because they said, look, some of these were services, some of these were products. You know, they were all these things, and the IRS just came up with an overall adjustment, which they made at the parent. And the tax court said the IRS also doesn't have to give that detail. As long as the consolidated adjustment is correct and they can justify that adjustment when we get to trial, then they do not have to go all the way down to the subs. The IRS has the discretion but is not required to do that. This does mean that that you may find that the IRS is going to make these sorts of adjustments in a consolidated basis at the top level now, but that may depend on how the Guidant case works out at actual trial. It's not clear that the IRS is going to be able to succeed at trial if they've done too much shortcutting of these adjustments. So whether or not this is an IRS win will be decided later, but it does mean they are not absolutely required to go do it at the subsidiary level. Next up, we're going to play a little bit with what's always a messy area of the law, the mitigation provisions of the Internal Revenue Code. Now, the mitigation rules are meant, and this case is the case of Costello versus Commissioner, Tax Court Memorandum Decision 2016-33. It was issued on March 1st of 2016. What happened in this case was it was kind of an odd situation that came about. The IRS was examining a trust that received an IRA distribution and that same year distributed funds from the IRA distribution to the beneficiaries of the trust. In the original return, the taxpayers had reported the IRA distribution as income on the trust return, but had taken an income distribution deduction for the distribution of that income out to the beneficiaries. Since the IRA distribution would be part of DNI, it actually would be carried out. However, apparently the agent didn't understand this, probably got tied up with the fact that most of the IRA distribution was not income under the State Principal and Income Act, and so rather came back and said, no. This should all be taxed, or at least the vast majority should be taxed at the trust level. They assessed, so he proposed an assessment of tax at the trust level. the trustee, rather than going to appeals or the tax court on this issue, signed off on it, paid the tax at the trust level, and at the same time, the IRS processed refunds on the returns for the two beneficiaries. Okay, net overall, the IRS gained on this because it turns out that the trust would pay a lot more tax than the beneficiaries had. In fact, it was basically the IRS ended up netting nearly $39,000 under that adjustment. Well, just about as the statute of limitations for filing a claim for refund on that particular issue arose, remember, you can always pay the tax and go to district court. When you do so, you first file an amendment. The trust filed an amended return claiming that the original return was correct and asking for the IRS to refund. In this case, the IRS agent who looked at the amended return actually understood how this should work and concluded that, in fact, yes, the deduction should have been allowed at the trust level. In essence, the original return was correct. The IRS approved a refund of the overpaid tax to the trust. But, and that's why probably these guys came in and did it just before the statute expired, by the time the IRS decided this and processed this, the statute for assessing tax against the beneficiaries had long since closed. Therefore, the IRS could not recover additional tax from the beneficiaries. Now the problem becomes, and you know, in essence, did the trust manage, by the fact the IRS fouled up on this, did they manage to effectively get money back? Did they, you know, in essence, so now we have both the beneficiaries paid no tax on this and the IRS paid and the trust paid no tax. Well, there are some special provisions in the code. You're going to find these provisions that will begin at section 1311, continue on for the next few sections. And these are the remediation provisions. These remediation provisions apply in certain cases. Generally, the problem is you've got to have a covered transaction. You've got to have an inconsistent position maintained. It's got to be actively maintained, and both at the time of the original filing and when the original event occurred that was inconsistent, and at the later date, at the original date that created this issue, plus the later date. The beneficiaries argued that, wait, no, the IRS did this. So we never maintain an inconsistent position. The tax court held that, no, you had maintained an inconsistent position because you accepted effectively the refunds. The beneficiaries and the trust are one of the relationships. Now, 1311 only applies to certain transactions, certain situations, but one of them found at 1312.5 specifically says that corrective deductions and inclusions between trust and beneficiaries are one of those things covered. The trust then went on and said, well, we had no relationship when the reversal took place because the trust had basically ceased to exist prior to the date the refund was filed. So therefore, there was no trust and beneficiary relationship at the date that we got the refund. The court disagreed with that, too. It said, look, you can't have your cake and eat it, too. If the trust really didn't exist and there's no trust, there's nobody to get a refund and nobody file a claim for refund. But if you claim that it exists enough to file a claim for refund, then, ladies and gentlemen, it exists enough for you to have, for the beneficiaries to have a relationship with it. Therefore, the IRS held that, in fact, the IRS could go ahead and get their money back from the beneficiaries, even though the statute of limitation on assessments had expired. Finally, guidance we had been waiting for. This is in the nature of proposed regulations and one temporary regulation dealing with the consistent basis reporting requirements that were added during this year by Congress. Last summer, Congress added the rules. You may remember, if you had a taxable estate, that estate had to file a report with the IRS regarding the basis of all assets that went to beneficiaries, and the beneficiaries have to report consistent with that. If they report a higher basis than the estate did, then there's an automatic penalty imposed. The Form 8971 to be filed with this was required to be filed by Congress 30 days after a 706 was filed. Well, that's kind of a problem because obviously, you know, that technically would have taken effect last summer. And at the end of August, we would have had to file the first ones for anybody unlucky enough to file their 706 on August 1st. They would have had to file by the 30 days after that. The IRS pushed those dates back, most recently to March 31st. They pushed it back to March 31st rather than February 29th because they were waiting on these regs. While these are proposed regs, they are issued in the form that taxpayers may rely upon them. They also represent the only guidance that we have currently in this area. So like it or not, these are what you're going to be using almost certainly to prepare the A-971s. And remember, if you filed an estate tax return between the 1st of August of last year and the end of what would be the end of February, you effectively have to get this form in by the end of March. Now, this form, a couple things they did. First, they clarified estates that don't have to file. One of the key things that was processed here that some people are concerned about, if an estate files solely to make a portability election under Section 2010, where the spouse dies, we want to take the spouse's unused exemption and transfer that to the surviving spouse. So when the surviving spouse dies, we can continue to use that exemption. If that's the only reason you're filing an estate tax returns, these regulations provide that that does not trigger a requirement to file the 8971, which is nice because some people had been worried the way the regulations and the law were written that the IRS, that it might be the proper interpretation was to essentially have to file that report. Secondly, the IRS also, though, said that there's some other things there. You'll find information about how you have to report if it's an entity, how you have to report if there's a contingent transfer. So if we have a contingent transfer to a beneficiary and it's later determined that the contingency occurred and the beneficiary won't get the asset, then generally we have to notify the service of that. We have to notify them various things. They also tell us how to do it if the 30 days are coming up. We've not yet distributed the assets to the beneficiaries. We have to give notice to each beneficiary of the basis and information on every asset they might get. That's also involved. One thing they added that was not in the law and has produced some commentary suggesting that this goes beyond the law because it was part of an original proposal when this was first brought up but was not in the final law. The law, these regulations provide if you receive assets from an estate that are reported on A-971 and you later transfer those assets to a related party, the recipient of the asset from the estate now has a requirement to file their own 4971 within 30 days after that transfer. We expect that to get a lot of not positive comments from individuals stating that, wait, that's not consistent with what the law said. So that's not a consistent issue. We'll see how the IRS and how everybody handles that going forward. But for right now, you're going to have to tell anybody who's received assets from an estate where the 706 was filed after August 1st, if they transfer those assets, for instance, they decide to gift those assets to their kids, they need to file an A-971 at least until we get the IRS to take this out of the regulations. This otherwise, I suppose you could take the position that that's not a legal regulation. Fine, but there are some very negative issues. By the way, other big negative here, if we later find an asset that was not included in the 706 or we simply didn't include an asset in the 706 for whatever reason, you may find out that the beneficiary has a zero basis in that asset. If that asset's discovered after the statute is closed for assessing tax against the estate and the estate had a tax liability or would have had a tax liability, then that particular asset has a zero basis. Similarly, if we didn't file an estate tax return, but we discover assets that require to be filed, we have to file that late return. Or if we discover assets when we had filed a return, we have to file a revised return if we're within the statute, or we're going to have the same problem at the beneficiary level. So there's a lot of pressure on executors to keep up, keep aware. And if we do have after discover assets, which I have seen more than once in my career, remember that now there's a significant issue that we have to deal with to make sure 8979 reporting gets there or our beneficiaries very likely end up with no basis when they sell that particular asset. This has been the current federal tax developments here for the week of March the 7th, 2016. Be sure to listen in to us. We're going to, again, as always, broadcast this every week. We're going to also be bringing you updates all during the week on our website at currentfederaltaxdevelopments.com. so be sure to visit us there. You can also sign up there for emails on articles related to tax matters that develop and other items, so you want to kind of keep your notices there. And the emails will come out whenever we publish an update on the site, and you'll see the link right there at the top of the site where you can sign up to become a recipient of these emails. Also, please be sure, as I said, starting the broadcast, take a look at your State Society of CPAs catalogs. Take a look. We have live courses that we'll be teaching coming up. In fact, I'm going to be going after tax season is done, very shortly after. I'll actually be doing fringe benefits courses in both Phoenix and Seattle, in the Seattle area, I should say Bellevue, actually, area. Also be doing an IT course in that area, I should say information technology, data, you know, what to do with clients who have ID theft problems. We'll be talking about that in an 8-hour session. So be sure to go ahead and take a look. The state societies are going to begin to start publishing their catalogs. Yes, unfortunately, when tax season ends, you got to start thinking about that stuff too. So be sure to check there. And we'll see you next week as part of the current federal tax developments, because I'm sure things will keep happening over the coming week.